nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
All righty, very pleasant good morning to you. This is Patrick Timpone. Here we go, hour two of our little show. We're live here, June 3rd, 2020. If you're watching, you can see a picture there of our next guest and myself on YouTube and also Facebook, or the audio on One Radio Network, Joe Salatin. Nice fellow. It's been a long time since we talked to you, Mr. Joe Salatin, lunatic farmer. Good morning.
Good morning, Patrick. It's great to be with
you. Nice to talk to you, brother. Where do you live?
In Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, which is in the western part of the state. Yeah.
Western Virginia. So are you kind of like far from the swamp there in Washington, D.C.? Are you getting swampy yet? Or?
Yeah, we're a little less than 3 hours from D.C., so it's far enough to be out in the hinterlands, but near enough that if we need to go in and take some hostages, we can get there pretty quick.
Attaboy. Joe Salatin, he calls himself a Christian libertarian. I love that. That's great, boy. You don't meet so many libertarian Christians around. You're probably one of the few. Environmentalist, he's a capitalist lunatic farmer. He calls himself the most famous farmer in the world at the High Priest of the Pasture. And his website is just great. They have a whole business model there where they sell cool stuff. And he's an author of 12 books. He has a new book out. And we talked to your co-author a couple of months ago, Joe. And the name of the new book is Beyond Labels.
That's right.
Beyond Labels, A Doctor and a Farmer Conquer Food Confusion One Bite at a Time, with Cinna McCullough, who was on the show, as I said, a few months ago. She's great, too. How'd you hook up with Cinna?
Well, Cinna and I did we shared a stage at a presentation down in Richmond, Virginia, one evening, and I had not heard of her, but I had seen that she'd written a book, Hands Off My Food, earlier, and realized here was a scientist who was not asking, she was just exposing the clever speak and just the fraud of labeling laws, and wanted people to understand the gig is up. The emperor has no clothes, whatever you want to say. But I was struck by, she wasn't asking for, well, we need new regulators or another agency. She said, look, it's up to you to learn about this. Anyway, I was struck by that, because it's kind of unusual in our space. Usually people that are foodie greeny kind of people are usually wanting some additional government oversight of something. So we shared this stage. I went down. She was first speaker. I was second speaker. And, I mean, I was completely captivated. Huh. And I do a lot of, traveling and speaking, so it takes a lot to, captivate me. I was on the edge of my seat, took 12 pages of notes. I said, man, this gal is dynamite. I got up, did my thing, and when I came down, then she grabbed me in the crowd. She says, I don't think she had ever heard me speak. She knew of me, but had not heard me speak. We got together then. I told her how wonderful she was. She told me how wonderful. She said, "Why don't we do a book together?" I said,
great.
"Yeah, why don't we?
Why
and
don't we?"
That's literally how it started.
Hmm. So this whole labeling thing, and so dig into a little bit about what the real message. What you guys put together on Beyond Labels. I mean, if I go to Whole Foods or my hippie food store and I look at those little labels, am I seeing everything that's in there?
No, of course you're not. And in fact, that's what Michael Pollan exposed in Omnivore's Dilemma, when he went to Whole Foods and saw the little red chicken, with the farmer there up on the big poster smiling. And he went to that farm and found the farmer and found that the farmer is actually it's a factory farm with 20,000 chickens in it, and wrote about it in Omnivore's Dilemma. I mean that's just clever speak, fraudulent messaging, whatever. The labeling thing, the actual words on the label are very carefully. They're very carefully regulated, and there are a lot of ingredients that are, people think the FDA is actually checking ingredients for toxicity, pathogenicity, hazards, things like that, and they're not. And the thing that I learned from Cena straight up was this grass thing, this generally accepted as safe grass, generally regarded as safe, recognized.
One of those.
A lot of stuff. I mean, even genetically modified organisms, all sorts of things fall under that category. These unpronounceable, you know, dyes and preservatives and things like that. They all fall under this GRAS grass category. They've never been checked. They've never been looked at. It's essentially this you know, industry policing itself kind of thing. And so the whole goal of the book is to have a conversation. And you know, the format is unique. I've never seen a book like this, where an actual, you know, credentialed PhD scientist regards a farmer as equal weight, and so the book is written like a dialogue, like you're sitting in a, you know, in an auditorium, and these two people are having a conversation on the stage. So Cena digs into the nutrition, the chemistry of stuff, in a very readable way, a great storyteller, and I then dig into what's actually happening on the farm. You know, when you get organic certified eggs, are they, you know, that pretty chicken sitting on the label that's on the, you know, the iconic board fence by the red barn with the cupola on top, that's not true. It's not real. It's actually, you know, a factory farm with, you know, 10,000 chickens in it. And so what the idea of the book was to take people where they are in their food journey and move them through to, well, you know, we call it a paradise, but to a better place. And so it's non-judgmental. It recognizes there are some people that are right now eating out of the gas station. You know, that would represent the, you know, that's the bottom, okay? But certainly many people eat out of the gas station. And what we want to do is lead you to better, you know, to better places, kind of coach you through to better places. And we end up, you know, clear out at the end of the book, we end up with, you know, your own herb garden and a chicken coop in the backyard and maybe honeybees on the roof. You know, now a lot of people, in fact, Cena and I are not in that, you know, perfect place. But we go all the way out there just to create a continuum, to show there is a continuum. It is a journey, and it's okay wherever you find yourself today, but we want to encourage you to go, you can always go to a better place. You can always go to a better place.
Joe Salatin, and he's co-authored his latest book. I think he has 12 or 13 of them now, Beyond Labels, and you get it all over the place. Chelsea Green, I think, your publisher, and you can go on Amazon and get it, or wherever you want, or go to Joe's website, Polyface Farm. So do you think then, I could send this book to, I have seven brothers and sisters who pretty much think I'm crazy, right? You know, because I've been in the health stuff forever. But this, they could read something like this, and it wouldn't scare them away and get them to a better place with their food choices.
Yes, this book is perfectly situated for that. In fact, in several of the cover endorsements, one of the most common themes of the endorsements was, wow, it's amazing to see something that's this, you know, straight, if you will, this convictional, but this welcoming, open, you know, catching people where you are. Because Cena, you know, she's got this amazing story of where she almost died from, you know, standard American diet. And, you know, I don't have a story like that. I mean, I've grown up on this farm. My dad and mom were, you know, they were organic weirdo foodies, you know, long before, you know, the organic movement came along, and grew up on this farm. We didn't use chemicals, and of course we were, you know, ostracized by the mainline Orthodox ag community as, you know, wackos, and during the, you know, the hippie days. And so I don't have that kind of a story. So to be able for the two of us to come to this conversation that people can listen in on as I learn about the the meaning of different words on labels, and from an urban sick mom situation, and what she's thinking, and as she learns about, you know, what I see on the farm and what makes a really good egg, what makes that orange yolk on an egg, those kinds of things, it's truly unique in a genre. And so what it does is it moves the book forward. I mean, you can, as you're reading, you know, Cena's part, you're wondering, well, what Joel's going to say about this. You're reading my part, you say, oh, I wonder what Cena's going to say about this. And so it moves, the action moves forward pretty aggressively. And I just think it's truly unique. There are a lot of co-authored books, and you can often sense the kind of the tension between authors as they work on a compatible language. The beauty of this for Cena and I was that we just said, let's not even try to make our language compatible. Let's take a topic, do your thing, I'll do my thing. You do your thing, I do my thing. And we make it very clear who's talking. It's like a playbook with just two actors. but that made it a little simpler, and it's a little clearer, and actually I think it's a little more exciting because you don't have some of the tension and stilted language that you see in co-authored books where you know where everybody's trying to get get into a composite groove.
Yes, sir. Joel Salatin's with us. If you care to join us, Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. We have a little farmer's market here, Joel Salatin, in Dripping Springs, and you can walk around and actually ask the people that do the chickens and their eggs, what do you feed your chickens? And you'd be surprised how many of them are saying, well, we do non-GMO, totally organic with no soy. So that's really interesting, isn't it, that this awareness is even out there, even for the chickens. But then there's this place called Terra Pureza. They do the regenerative farming like you do. And they're outside of Austin, and they have the pigs and the pig's feet and the chicken and the eggs. And I got to tell you, they have the most orange or yolks, even more so than the other ones, you know. And I want to know, because everybody lines up for them because they always run out of eggs because their eggs are like amazing.
Right.
What could the regenerative farming, what could they be doing there, and what you do, how to come up with these real deep, rich orange yolks, even more than the people that are doing a good job with cage-free and feeding organic feed? Why would they come out like this?
Well, it probably has to do with the pasture that they're on. It's because it's the carotenes, it's the green material, the salad, if you will, that actually has the vitamins and minerals that makes those yolks orange. And so, I well remember back, we used to go to farmer's market here in Stanton, our nearest city, 20,000 people. It's not a great big city, but had a farmer's market back many years ago. We were instrumental in helping it get started. We went for 3 years and then finally gave up because it just was not an efficient venue. But anyway, I would crack our eggs, you know, and put them out there for folks to see. And there were four or five other vendors there who had eggs. And in the 3 years we were there, not a single one of them would ever crack their eggs to show what they were like. And the reason is because even if they're outside, they're on a dirt, you know, they're in some sort of a dirt run. It's not rotated. They're not getting green grass. And they're small scale and they're farmsteading it. But typically the birds are on the same ground every day. There's no grass, there's no pasture. And I mean, chickens don't eat a lot of grass, but a little bit goes a long way for a chicken, and it really makes a big difference in the yolk color.
So is there a big difference, Joel Salatin, in the goodies that we get from eggs from somebody that's doing a regenerative agriculture, and then they're feeding even the organic feed, whatever they use? Is it more beneficial for us nutritionally on the regenerative, on more grass and less feed?
Sure. And that's why we break it at pastured, and I go into the book. I go into detail the difference between, you know, pastured eggs and there's no label for pastured. Okay, that's just a phrase to describe, and you have to, you know something about your farmer, whether you check them out on a website or go visit or know somebody who has visited. You know, this is the personal. The personal vetting and sleuthing that Cena and I encourage in the book, and so you know, you can turn off Netflix once in a while and actually, you know, sleuth and vet your food provenance, and so yes, the nutritional difference is profound.
We
actually years ago, Mother Earth News magazine, you're probably familiar with it.
Yes.
They commissioned a, because they got tired of this. You know, an egg is an egg is an egg. You call up the USDA, you get the nutritional label, you slap it on your carton. And they got tired of just hearing this all the time, there's no difference. And so they commissioned a food lab to do a nutritional study, and 12 of us around the country participated in it. And they checked for about 10 nutrients, 10 things. And I'll just give you one, folic acid, and that's important for pregnant women, and it's an essential fatty acid. And the official USDA label says an egg has something like, 48 micrograms in it of folic acid, and our eggs average 1,038
really?
Micrograms per egg. And so when you look, when you looked at the spreadsheet, at the chart on this study, I mean, the pastured eggs, I mean, they varied, but in general, compared to the USDA, I call it the U.S. Duh, the U.S. Duh,
Duh
label.
Duh. U.S. Duh.
Duh. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it didn't even look like it was the same product. They were that far
really?
Different.
Wow. Yeah, it's similar to, so I want to ask you before the first break, so you can go to HEB like in Texas, and it's a great organization. They have really, they do a good job, you know, for a commercial food store. They have a lot of organic things in there, a lot of non-GMO stuff. But then they'll have on their in their egg department organic, cage-free eggs, and they even say no soy, if you can believe that. No soy, you know. So they know that people are into that. Do we have any idea how these guys are really? Is there any laws or statutes or anything? What are they really running around, or do we know?
No, we don't. In fact, the official U.S. DUH definition of free range is freedom of movement of all appendages. Now, I guarantee you, if you took that term free range chicken and you gave it, you got 10 moms in there and said, please write what you think this means, free range chicken. Not a single one of them would say what this means is that the chicken has enough room to extend its wings and legs.
Oh, my goodness. No. Does it really just mean that? Oh,
yeah. That's the official U.S. DUH. So so that's why there's so much, clever speak and manipulation of the vocabulary in this, and why it's essential to turn off Netflix, get off the couch, and go invest a little bit of time and energy in provenance.
In God, in nature.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, stay right there. We're going to do a quick little break here. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. If you have a question, a comment for Joe Salatin, you can try the telephone, 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. I've known Daniel Vitalis for 12 years now, and good man, and boy, they got some terrific products. Listen, Stephen Buhner, master herbalist, wrote an entire book on pine pollen. Previously, we asked him, what's the difference between gathering some pine pollen, eating that, and then maybe taking Sir Thrival pine pollen and the grape alcohol, the tincture? What's the difference in the body?
Okay, the difference is pine pollen is probably one of the best nutrient food substances on the earth. And you see, it's made to be uptaken by all of the life around it. All of the other plants take it in and use it for growth. Many of the animals eat it, and it's a very nutrient substance. If you eat it, what happens is it goes through your GI tract and then puts it into the bloodstream. And there's a lot of great stuff in it. I mean, it's really high in amino acids and protein and vitamins. So it's a very magnificent substance. It's kind of a nutrient longevity tonic food. And it will, over time, raise levels. But if you really want to raise them fast, you don't want to let it go through your GI tract, hence the use of a tincture.
And you can click and order this great product right on our website. Any of these are Thrival links. Take you right to the pine pollen and order away. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Maybe you could tell me what you think is going on here. And please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever. It wasn't brains that got me here, I can assure you of that.
Previously, with research scientists at MIT, Stephanie Seneff, PhD, and the curious connections between these glyphosates, Roundup, GMOs, and sulfur.
So if you simply put the glyphosate in place of the glycine in the sulfotransferase, you will not be able to get the sulfate from the cholesterol sulfate to some other molecule, such as the heparin sulfate. The cell won't be able to defend itself with sulfate if it can't put the sulfate there. But it's really, really important to be able to do that because, for example, cholesterol sulfate, it delivers sulfate to the cells. But in order to deliver it, you've got to take the sulfate off of the cholesterol and put it on something else. And that's what where the sulfotransferase would come in and wouldn't be able to do that.
I know, gets a little geeky, but the point is that without the proper amount of sulfur in the body, and now it's being disrupted because of the GMOs, even more than what it was already doing, it's not good. So we think that this sulfur product that we've been promoting is really helping people to keep everything kind of working well, because this whole sulfur cycle is kind of God's way of keeping the bad guys out and exiting the body. And because our sulfur is absolutely pure with no additives, it's different from almost all the other ones out there. You can click an order, three prices, right on our website, OneRadioNetwork.com.
Yeah, we get that a lot. And why is your sulfur? We've been selling it for the same price for 6 years. It just costs more. It's just clean. There's nothing else in there except pure sulfur. And virtually everyone out there, everyone has silicone dioxide. And I think they do that because they also use the same product to put in capsules, and they think they need to use silicone dioxide to so it'll flow. But sulfur is a very persnickety, and one of the reasons why sulfur doesn't like GMOs and Roundup and stuff like that, that it's a pretty persnickety chemical. It's probably female and knows what it's doing. You know, females are. So this is a great product. Costs a little more, but you're going to really enjoy it. People have said for years they remember more of their dream experiences when you're sleeping and you're going to play with the angels, because theoretically it helps to kind of help open up the third eye kind of thing and talk to divine spirit. And I think that's true, but that's another story. Sulfur, OneRadioNetwork.com.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.
We're talking with Lunatic Farmer. Where did you get that name? I mean, you don't sound like a lunatic, Joe Salatin. You sound pretty sane to me.
You'd be surprised. You know, when you start rattling the orthodoxy chain, dogs start to bark. And over the years, I've run amok, of course, of the conventional industrial agriculture paradigm that wants to pour chemicals all over everything. I've run amok, of course, the factory farm deal with our pastured idea. I've run amok of the whole food system by daring to say, well, you know, maybe small farmers can brand their own products and sell to their own neighborhoods, and we can have hundreds of thousands of these small farmers around and have more resilience in tough times. And certainly, today's pandemic is showing the fragility of the of having just a handful of massive food processors rather than a diversified, democratized, decentralized system of small ones. Anyway, the point was that people would accuse me of wanting to kill half the planet because, we can't feed the world this way.
Yes,
not taking care of animals because I don't vaccinate them, blah, blah, blah. And so, and I said, you can either get frustrated and upset and depressed about this pushback, or she could just say, yep, I am crazy, of course, and have fun with it.
Yeah, have fun.
And
so it's probably, you know, if they do any kind of mandatory vaccine ID card, your pigs are not going to be able to travel. So, you know, that'll be tough. But
right.
You can
right.
deal
we'll
with
have,
that.
We'll have to find an alternative airline. That's right.
How is it that you know, this whole thing with China and the pigs, and they killed like billions of them with some kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that, and how can your pigs be okay if you haven't vaccinated them? I mean, what's up with that?
Yeah, so, well, it's kind of two threads here you're asking. First mm-hmm. of all, African swine fever,
yes.
ASF, it's the African swine fever. You know, we Americans, we can't talk in multisyllabic things, so we talk in alphabet soup. So African swine fever came into China. I mean, well, it really hit them a couple of years ago, and China right now is about they have killed roughly 50% of their entire pork population. Now this is important because China eats, you ready for this? They eat half the world's pork. In America, the number one, you know, meat that Americans eat is chicken. In China, it's pork by a long shot, you know, mugu gai pan. Think of all the pork dishes that you go to a Chinese restaurant. So pork, for China to drop half of its domestic inventory of pork was just, it's been catastrophic. Pork prices have gone way up. The government's pulled stuff out of inventory. It's been one of those kind of stories that people like me follow, but the average person doesn't really follow that much.
Sure, right.
Well, China, if you're following that, know that the Chinese bought Smithfield, America's largest pork a pig company.
Yes, sir.
What, you know, 5 years ago.
Yes, sir.
And so the number one pork company in the U.S. is now owned by the Chinese. And so with the African swine flu in China, they of course are taking a lot of American pork to China to satisfy their domestic production until they can get ahead of this and come on. So when the pandemic hit, when the coronavirus hit, and American processors began shutting down, now Smithfield was still sending 20% of their pork to China, even when our supermarket shelves were empty, and so it wasn't a problem with production; it was a problem with processing, and so. You know, so what's the solution? You know, where do we go from here? So I think the second thread of the conversation is your worldview or your paradigm, how you view wellness and sickness. And our view here at our farm at Polyface, we believe essentially sickness, the default position of nature is wellness. Nature's default position is wellness. And if something is not well, then we humans, we probably messed it up. We managed it incorrectly. We did something that broke down the immunological, hedge of protection, mm-hmm. and allowed a sickness to come in. And so we don't view vaccines, for example, as the answer to sickness. We view building immunity. So we've been here on the farm now for almost 60 years, and I can look back and I can tell you about three, well, they call them epizootics in animal. Another, you know, when you have a sickness go through a herd or a flock or something.
Mm-hmm.
We've had that three times here at the farm over the past, in the last 60 years, and every single time it was our fault.
Wow.
Every time we either had a dietary issue, where they weren't getting the right feed. Maybe we confined them. One time it was in a herd of calves. Once we rented a new place, and it had been kind of abandoned for years, had all these blackberry bushes, brambles in it. So we were moving the mineral box around in the brambles to get the cattle to stomp them down, and And they got a disease called blackleg from the anaerobic puncture wounds from what we were turning them into pincushions.
Interesting.
And so now there is a vaccine for it, and almost every farmer anywhere, you know, tells you you have to vaccine for it. But its point of access is when you don't take care of the animals or don't have them in a real good spot. And so when we mowed the brambles down, then we didn't have any more problem. And so and we've seen that over and over and over again. So we're pretty confident that the reason coronavirus came, and whatever your thoughts about it, mm-hmm. is not because coronavirus did not come because we lacked a vaccine.
We were vaccine short, right?
That's yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like the cosmos looked down on the planet and said, you know what? They don't have a coronavirus vaccine, so you know what? We're going to go down and give them coronavirus. You know, so they.
It just doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. There's always something wrong that breaks down the immunological function.
Do you think then that the same then and the germ theory thing doesn't really, as we say in Texas, that dog doesn't really hunt, does it?
That's right.
Right. It just doesn't hunt. So even in animals and people, your conjecture is that most of these things we create because our immune system and our microbiome and all this stuff gets messed up just like it did with your pigs or your cows times over 60 years, right?
And it could be. I mean, it could be an environment thing. You know, I mean, I'm well aware that there's everything blamed for this from 5G to glyphosate to the CIA to the the Chinese right. to the Rothschilds and the Trilateral Commission. You know, I've seen it all. Okay, but let's just assume for a moment that it did simply spring up out of those horrendous bat seven. Wildlife markets in Wuhan that are atrociously filthy, but because they're an aphrodisiac and offer sexual prowess, rich and wealthy people patronize them for their glands and things. It's part of their culture.
Huh. Bat glands make you frisky. I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. My.
Yeah. bats somehow can find their partners without even being able to seeing.
I see. I mean, yeah, that'll work.
That's homing instinct, right?
That'll work. So let's just assume, like you say, Mr. Salatin, that that's maybe just assume for the moment that that's where this thing came from. So it could be a thing that's floating around potentially that actually came here from China that is attacking us or what?
Yeah. That was a kind of a new mutation a recipe of pathogenicity mm-hmm. that finally got the right amount of whatever time, players, temperature, and launched this thing. The point is that you can't be putting that kind of filth, especially with wild animals, in an urban setting without overrunning nature's protective barriers. Any more than you can put 20,000 chickens in a confinement house and not overrun protective barriers. It just is. And now when it jumps from animal to human, obviously that's a new state of virulence, and I understand that. But we have seen this throughout history. I mean, the whole guns, germs, and steel thing mm-hmm. was about animal-human interaction and relationships, and a certain exposure is wonderful, but everything can be taken to an overexposure, and then you have a new issue.
So, a big picture, though, if something came around that was actually in the air floating around a la Louis Pasteur
germ theory
right.
thing.
Right.
Your your piggies and cows could be just fine, thank you, because of your regenerative farming techniques, the way you
yes.
take care of them.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the flip side, I said, you know, we've had three or four epizootics in time past because of our mismanagement. Mm-hmm. We've also had several times in time past when, for example, neighbors had epizootics of, you know, one had a coccidiosis outbreak, one had a pink eye outbreak. We've had numerous issues, you know, where our animals are rubbing noses with their animals, okay, through the fence,
mm-hmm.
you know, neighbors. And our animals have never gotten sick, even with that level of exposure.
Interesting.
And Sir Albert Howard, when he was doing his work in Indore in India and then subsequently wrote an agricultural testament, they had a foot and mouth outbreak there, highly communicable, highly contagious. And he did an experiment where he took corrals of cattle and he fed one pen grass that was fertilized with chemical fertilizer and one pen with grass that was fertilized with the compost. He was making compost from the tea plantations. He called it Cecil compost. And over the 10 years that he replicated this several times, he put known carriers in of hoof and mouth in each of the corrals with the cattle, and in no case did the compost fertilized grass pen did an animal in there get foot and mouth, but over in the chemical fertilized grass pen, not all of them got it, but several got it. And so his whole conclusion was you feed, you eat toward immunity, you eat toward optimal function, and you know, now you're down to Antoine Beauchamp, right, or the
yes.
contemporary of Louis Pasteur, who developed the terrain theory,
mm-hmm.
and which is of course the underpinning of the entire wellness movement. And wellness is more than diet. It's in the book we talk about hydration. You know, most mm-hmm. Americans don't drink water because the water tastes bad. And so you know, you got to hydrate. You got to get enough sleep. I mean, Beauchamp was big on this. You know, and this was back in the mid 1800s, and he said we're not sleeping enough. We need 8.5 hours of sleep.
Did Beauchamp believe then we had all of these little buggies, good, bad, and ugly, and whatever, all in ourselves, and that we created these guys from inside?
Yeah, well, I don't know. He agreed that we had all these bugs, but his position was that there were more good bugs than bad bugs, and so the whole idea is to create a habitat, a terrain, in which the good bugs can overpower the bad bugs. I mean, we see this on our own farm, and I bring this out in the book, in the industrial farm, they try to sterilize everything. But like between batches, let's just say chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Between batches of chickens, they go and they clean out, and they spray it down, they sterilize it, hit it with chlorine, you know, and try to just antimicrobial the whole thing. In our brooder house, because all of our chickens are on pasture, but we start them, of course, in a brooder house. We don't start them right on pasture when they're just hatched right out of the egg. So they're a couple weeks in the little brooder house, protect them, and we can keep them warm. And what we do, we don't clean out ever completely. We actually maintain a very deep bedding, like 12 to 24 inches deep, that is actually composting, so that we have a terrain of good bugs that keeps the chicks healthy. And even when we clean out, we don't clean it completely out. We leave some of last year's bedding in there to inoculate this year's, so we don't lose. It's kind of like a yogurt culture, you know, or a sourdough. You don't want to lose that all that bacterial culture that keeps everything healthy. And that's whole recognition of the microbial, of the microscopic soup in which we live is just such a different kind of paradigm,
yes,
worldview,
yes,
than the people that are running around there wanting to sanitize and sterilize everything. We literally have so much networking and commerce going on in our bodies that there are something like 3 trillion exchanges being made per second.
Whoa.
In our body. You know, I'll trade you a mineral for a spot of sugar. I'll trade you a virus for a white blood cell. I mean, we have literally trillions of those kinds of interactions going on our skin, in our hair, on our hands, in our bodies, every single second, which makes this whole wear a bandana thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a joke. It's floating around. It's here, and I'm waiting for somebody to push Anthony Fauci aside at those presidential things, step up to the microphone and say, okay, everybody, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do this. We want 1 week nationwide. We're going to do a nationwide initiative to increase our immune system for 1 week.
Huh.
So we don't want anybody to go to McDonald's for Happy Meals. We want you to throw out your Coca-Cola and Pepsi and your Snickers bars, and we're gonna drop off of sugar. We're gonna get outside, get some vitamin D, get some exercise. We're gonna sleep 8.5 hours. We're gonna drink 3 quarts of water a day. And you know what? We're also gonna forgive. We're gonna forgive everyone that we don't like.
Oh, there you go. Now you're getting there, dude. Now you're getting there, Joe Salad. Yeah, good for you. And there's actually beginning to come out with some studies, not in the long term, but some real interesting studies showing that the whole shelter-in-place thing is causing more harm than good.
Yeah.
Because the folks aren't getting out there and getting a little, sharing the bugs with everybody. And
that's right.
Getting
that's
along.
Right. Your immune system, is like a big muscle. It needs exercise.
Uh-huh.
And so when you don't expose yourself to any of this, then it becomes lethargic, and you get into a... Then when you do finally go out, then you have a reaction with colds and things like that, that you wouldn't have otherwise gotten,
mm-hmm,
because of the lack of exercise of your immune system.
So that's pretty much the idea behind regenerative farming, where you're letting everybody get together and party down a little bit, bugs and whatever,
yes,
pigs and cows, and everybody, yes, just shares everything because it's just,
yes,
one big glob of God.
Well, yeah, it is. It is. And nature is extremely relationally complex.
Mm-hmm.
And so our temptation as farmers is to simplify it, to come down, to grow one species, to simplify things. And nature doesn't like that simplification. Nature likes this real, complexity and relational stuff. And that's why very few pathogens actually jump species. They're very species specific, because then when you have all this complexity, a pathogen hatches out over here and suddenly an animal comes on that's toxic to it, a cow, say, versus a pig or a chicken. And that pathogen dies because there's no host, and there's a hoof when it wants a beak.
Hmm.
and so that's actually how the complexity, the diversity in nature works, and it's a good thing.
Joe Salatin, his latest book, Beyond Labels. I think you have 12 or 13 books now, Joe. I don't know how you do that in farm, and I don't understand that. You could probably. It's probably pig's feet that does it for you, right? It's probably
I don't have a TV.
You don't,
that helps a lot.
There you go. And his website is Polyface Farms. And do folks still come, and do you have tours all the time there?
Absolutely. In fact, during this pandemic, everything's locked down. I said, look, everybody come out to the farm, walk barefoot through the pasture, stick your hands in some compost.
Hmm.
Let's get some fresh air, exercise, breathe in all that bacteria coming off of the grass and the, mm-hmm, cows, and Let's exercise our immune system.
Party down. Do you have children? Did you have children born on the farm?
Yeah, we do. So our son runs day-to-day operations, so I can do this kind of thing.
So your son, he was born on the farm?
Yeah. So I'm second generation. I mean, mom and dad bought the farm here when I was just 4 years old. So I grew up here, and then, of course, our kids have grown up here, and now we have grandkids here as well.
And do they, are they kind of get out there and just share the bugs and everything, and do they do well doing that, this idea of let your kids crawl around the grass and they're going to get vaccinated?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, very, very healthy.
Here's an email for you from Ron. He's in Hawaii. Aloha. In Joe's opinion, does he think that American farming would be better off for a farmer to own and operate, say, 1,000 acres of land, as an example, or for 1,000 farmers to own and operate 1 acre? That's an interesting question.
That's an interesting question. So, yeah, it's about scale. And so I've seen extremely well-run, very, very small farms, and I've seen extremely, extremely well-run, very large farms. Don't get hung up on scale. Get hung up on management and what's happening to the land. Is as a result of that farming enterprise, is soil being built? Is there better hydration of the landscape? Is there more life diversity, more breathable air? You know, is that what's happening? Hmm. And that really can be done in a backyard postage stamp. And it can be done on a very large ranch, if the management mimics the kind of movement that the bison and things went across, how they went across the landscape. So it's not about a scale; it's about management, and some operations are more conducive to being managed well when they're small, and others are more conducive to being managed well when they're bigger. Like herds of cows tend to be managed better. When there are more of them, it's just easier to duplicate, the herds of nature. And when it comes to things like, rose bushes and green beans, sometimes it's a lot easier to do it on a very small scale because they're very intensive.
Yes, sir. So you do everything, eggs and poultry and pork and beef and different things. Where do you sell all your goods that you produce?
Right. So we have several threads that we sell. We have a farm store here. So people come here to the farm and buy things. We also sell online. So we ship nationwide.
Really?
We can ship to anyone in the country. And that is growing very, very rapidly. We just launched that last year in July. And we're thankful we did, because with the pandemic, it has just exploded. And so we were fortunately kind of through the initial getting acquainted part of that for us to get the bugs worked out. And then the other thing we do is we deliver to about 30 urban neighborhood drop points within 4 hours of the farm here. And we service about 4,000 families through that. We service them once a month, so every month we go. And we collaborate with numerous other farmers, grass-based cheese from a grass-based dairy, kimchi, kombucha, soup, broth. I mean, there's numerous things that we collaborate with other artisans in the area that either use our stuff and value add it, or like in the case of other products, kombucha and things like that, make their own. And so we service these drop points, and people meet us there at an appointed time. We also serve about 50 restaurants. Many of them, of course, are right now, they're not even open.
Yes.
We don't know how many will survive, but I'll tell you, this coronavirus has moved us from kind of a, about 30% of our sales going to restaurants to almost none going to restaurants, but the retail has tripled.
I bet so.
So it's been quite a financially rewarding time.
So in general, and we have listeners all over the world, if folks wanted to kind of do this for them, first off, I guess you have to get into it. It's a lot of work, right? There's no doubt about that. I mean, you better be prepared to work, right?
But I mean, you know, to me, it's a lot of work to sit in your car 3 hours a day fighting expressway traffic to your Dilbert people.
And then get Wi-Fi, you know, when you go to work, right? So do you think there's enough, and are you on top of it, Joe Salatin, of the amount of restaurants and farmers markets could support a lot of small 5-acre farms doing pigs and cows and chickens and eggs and stuff?
Well, when you say 5 acres, you know, that's pretty small. Mm-hmm. Now you're looking more at produce or vegetables.
Okay.
And specialty things like, you know, like blackberries, raspberries, strawberries. You know, those are all perfect things for, you know, 5-acre farms. When you start getting into especially the bigger stuff, pork, lamb, beef, and poultry to some extent, you start getting into the livestock, it becomes a little problematic in 5-acre places, and you just don't get economies of scale. I mean, we move our cows every day, so if you're going to move cows, you want to move 300. You don't want to move 2. So there are definitely some economies of scale when you move into the livestock. But yes, the 5-acre farm, I mean, spin farming and the, you know, intensive stuff like Singing Frog's Farm in Petaluma and Jean-Martin Fortier, the stuff that Elliot Coleman does in Maine. These are gurus of this new, very intensive, non-chemical approach, and it's truly inspiring and dramatic.
How is it different from what you're doing at Polyface?
Well, they're in produce. They're not in animals.
Oh, in produce. Just
yeah,
produce.
Yeah. And produce, again, produce is more expensive per square foot, so you can generate more income per square foot with produce than you can with animals. And that's why generally when you think about urban farming and being you know, embedded in the urban sector, you're thinking more about produce that's highly watery, and as you move out to the livestock where you're transporting a little farther, you're looking at way more nutrition per pound. The amount of nutrition per pound of, say, beef is way more different than the nutrition per pound of cucumber. A pound of cucumber will leave you know, unsatisfied.
Yeah.
A pound of beef will leave you know, totally satiated. In fact, you probably don't want to eat a pound of it. So from a big picture standpoint, in general, you want to take your watery produce type stuff closer and intensify it and smaller scale, and your more extensive stuff that's more nutrient dense per pound, that can be farther away because you can justify to transport it farther because it's more nutrient dense per pound as opposed to a watermelon or a squash.
Yes, sir. Lee is in New York, wants to know, does your guest believe that if we buy some product from the food store, the supermarket or the natural food store, and it says organic USDA, that it is in fact all organic?
Oh boy. Well, the organic, it's not. I mean, it can be hydroponic, which, you know, we're the only country in the world that certifies hydroponic. That's produce grown without soil. No country in the rest of the world recognizes soilless systems as organic, but the U.S. does, and it's so dramatic that it has created several alternative labels. There's a Beyond Organic, a Real Organic label. There's a Eco Verified. There's numerous labels out there now that are trying to, you know, supplement the organic because it has become so compromised. It doesn't mean that the animals weren't raised in a factory farm. Most of the milk and the eggs, the poultry grown in that it's organic certified, is not grown on pasture at all. Pigs, organic certified pigs, not grown on pasture. In fact, half of the organic certified grain in the U.S. is imported from foreign countries. Most of it through Istanbul in Turkey. From the stand countries, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, all those stand countries, and so there's constant fraud. There's constant fraud in that paperwork. So that's why we don't play the organic certification game. We buy from farmers that we know, local, GMO free. We test it for glyphosate and things like that. And so many of these farmers are beyond organic, but they just don't want to. There's a lot of us like me who exceed organic in most areas, but we just don't want to fill out a bunch of paperwork and pay all the money to the USDA for something that's as adulterated as the government organic label.
Interesting. So you don't even mess with your whole organic label thing. You just rely on people knowing who you are and what you do.
That's correct.
Very interesting.
And we have a 24/7, 365 open door policy. Anyone can come here from anywhere in the country at any time to see anything anywhere unannounced. Okay. That's our promise of transparency.
Joe Salatin, his latest book, I'm going to get it, and it's called Beyond Labels. Can you stick around a few more moments?
Yeah.
Cool. Stay right there, because I have more questions for Mr. Salatin. How about this one here? Previously with Brandon Amalani of Shen Blossom, talking about our very special ginseng.
And you don't want something that's been corrupted coming into your body. Like the ginseng is a super important example of that. You know, when you're using aggressive alcohols and solvents, it has a strange effect with ginseng, in the sense that when you're not only over processing it, but putting it in really aggressive alcohols, what's going to happen is that you're going to flip the chemistry on some of the androgenic. Naturally, it's androgenic. It's going to basically protect the telomeres and add life to the body and protect the genetic replication of the cells. But it's also going to boost the androgens and boost the male hormones in the body. But if you incubate it in really aggressive alcohol, it flips those to become estrogenic. Now, estrogens, phytoestrogens, are not necessarily bad in balance, but you really don't want that with your ginseng, especially if you're getting like a really high quality, a really old root, something that's very special. You want to like treat it with care and make sure it's delivering what ginseng has to offer.
Just a short clip from Brandon talking about the way they do the ginseng, just to give you a better idea of where this company is coming from, the quality and the ethics. Brandon and the Shen Blossom link on OneRadioNetwork.com. What a wonderful man. I've known Brandon all the way since the Daniel Vitalis days when he was working, and you can hear and look at his products on Shen Blossom. They really... If you're going to trade those Federal Reserve notes, such as they are, for good things, you know, do it for good food, like we're talking about with Joe Salatin, and do it for some products that people like Brandon and Daniel Vitalis that are doing these products that are like, whoa. I mean, they're really into it, and they're using Myron Glass and all totally obviously organic and fruited bodies. And Brandon has some purple reishi mushroom that I just got some of that, and you take some drops of that, it's like wine. I mean, these medicinal mushrooms are very, very powerful. Shen Blossom, so if you're going to spend your money, if you're going to trade your Federal Reserve notes for products, do it from places like this where we know the source, our trademark, so you're getting the most bang for those Federal Reserve notes.
Lisa wants to know, what does Dr. Cowden think about the far red fried saunas, as Patrick is always talking about, for detox?
Yeah, I like infrared saunas, near-infrared and far-infrared both. So those help to shake loose from our cells the toxins that are trapped inside our cells, and they go into the extracellular space. If you're working on your lymphatic system, then the toxins that are in the extracellular space will go into the lymphatic vessels and travel back to the central circulation and be pumped by the heart through the kidneys and into the urinary bladder and toilet, or through the liver and the gallbladder and the bowel, and finally into the toilet. And so that is an excellent way to detoxify.
Thank you, Dr. Lee Cowden. He wasn't particularly promoting our specific sauna, per se. but it's certainly a good understanding from his perspective how this works. These are great units, low EMFs. I'll give you a sale price.
Sale price. Well, kind of, sort of. We have the lowest price, thank you, Patrick, in the world on these little guys, and they're allowing us to do it as long as we don't put it in print. So the suggested retail price doesn't travel around the world through Twitter and Google and kind of mess it up. It's $1,150. $1,150. These are wonderful units. I think you're going to enjoy them. We had an email from a fellow who bought one 10 years ago, still going strong. I've had mine over 10 years. It just flip it on, and boy, they get warm. They get, you'll sweat. You will sweat. And then the far infrared were the lights, you know, to help detoxify at a deep level. Great detoxification tool. It also kind of balances out the sympathetic nervous system, so to help you sleep and to relax, lower the lactic acid in your little heart muscles and all that. Great stuff. The far infrared sauna. If you'd like to get one, the only way you get the right price is email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com, and we ship them all over the world, everywhere, all over the world, and we've shipped them to Japan, actually into China, South Korea, and of course over in Europe, Canada, Hawaii, all over the world. The $1,150 price is the lower 48. That's the lower 48. For those of you in Portlandia, that means not Alaska or Hawaii. And just email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com.
We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on oneradionetwork.com.
Joseph Salatin, you're the only person that's ever called himself a libertarian farmer. I mean, that's good. I like it. So what does that mean? You're a free market kind of guy? Free market kind of guy?
Well, it means I'm a small government kind of guy. I don't have all the free markets sorted out, actually, philosophically, but for sure, the government governs best that governs least. And so I'm not an anarchist, but in general, I think that the federal government's about, you know, 95% too big. And
cannibal.
And I'm a big believer in the 50 state experiment, and I think that generally everything that has been arrogated to the federal level should have been handled at the state level. I mean, what's wrong with one state saying we don't think education is any prerogative of the government at all, mm-hmm. and another state saying, oh, we think that the government should pay for every child's education? And then you can have two separate systems side by side, and you can look over the state line, see how things going over there, how things going over here, and of course then lots of other, you know, those are two extremes, but obviously other things in between. What and the fact that we have arrogated to the federal level so many of these things that used to be done at the state level, it has created this extremely toxic effect at the federal level, because it's a winner take all. At the state level, you know, it's way smaller, so the stakes aren't as high, and so you don't have the the political war going on because it's simply smaller. And so, if people, different groups have tried to get me to run for office, you know, I said, listen, if you knew what I think, you know, I could never be elected. I mean,
that'd last, you know, about 20 minutes, right, Joe?
You'd say, about 20 minutes.
Joe Salatin is here, Polyface Farm. So many of our nutritional people, and we talk to lots of folks, Joe Salatin, over the years, really are wanting to make sure we're getting plenty of good fats in our diet, right? The pigs and the pig fat and pig's feet and those kind of things, and other kind of fat. But also, grass-fed and grass-finished beef has this kind of reputation where it doesn't have as much fat. How do you reconcile that? Do you think a grass-fed steak thing is still good nutrition?
Oh, absolutely. again, we're talking about degree.
Okay.
Too often, and I can raise my hand as guilty of this as well. Early on, when the movement began gaining traction with the with the writing of Michael Pollan and things like that, the market exceeded the supply for a period of time, and so farmers like us, desperate to leverage this new the phone ringing off the hook, we selected too deep into our herds and slaughtered. We processed animals that weren't finished, too young, too juvenile. And this gave grass finishing a bad reputation. Today, we've learned that lesson and are letting them go longer and get more mature and get that fat level up a lot more.
Okay.
And so we've kind of corrected a lot of that. But as so many things happen, you get burned once, you don't give it a second try. And so so back 10, 12 years ago, this was a big problem. But today, the industry, the understanding of what grass finished is, has matured a lot. And we're seeing much, much better quality come to the market.
So cows, moo cows, pigs, or whatever, they can get plenty of good fat just eating grass.
Well, the herbivores can, cows and sheep.
Cows and sheep.
Pigs and chickens, they're omnivores, and they can't, they want to eat. Grass is more a tonic for them. It's more like a vitamin pill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they can... And now, a mature pig, a sow, for example, a sow who is pregnant, if she gets some really good quality alfalfa or clover, some real high protein stuff, she can almost make it on a forage-based diet. But growing stock, they need higher octane. The higher octane can come either from waste produce, starchy waste produce, potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar beets, things like that, or most normally it comes from grain.
From grain. So, mm-hmm. What about all this grass, like corn? Remember the time of corn-fed beef and all that? What was that all about? And do cows really? Can they even digest corn?
Oh, sure they can. I mean, that's can you digest cotton candy? you can, but that doesn't mean it's good for you.
I see.
And so. Cows can digest corn, but it does real funny things with their digestion. It makes their digestion go to acidosis, very, very acid. The juice inside the cow's rumen is not very acid. And as you go into the grain feeding for an herbivore, it makes the digestive system go extremely acid, which is the basis of these Campylobacter, Listeria, these high acid loving critters that we now have a problem with, that our highly acid system used to kill many, many years ago, but today these bugs have been culturated in a more acidic environment because of the grain feeding. And so when those acidified bugs come into us, instead of us killing them, they kill us because they're already acid acclimated.
Wow. Oh, that's interesting. Does grass-fed, grass-finished label mean anything, whether in natural food stores or conventional markets that carry grass-fed, grass-finished?
Yeah. Grass-fed now means nothing.
No.
Because the label speak right now, and Cena and I point this out in the book Beyond Labels.
Mm-hmm.
We point out that right now the industry is using grass-fed. Their position is if a cow gets one blade of grass in its lifetime, it's grass-fed. And technically, devil's advocate. Technically, they're right. I mean, so it ate grass one day, But the grass-fed, again, the idea of grass-fed, if you get 10 10 moms in a room and say, could you please write to me what you think when you hear the phrase grass-fed? Not a single one of them will say, that means the animal has had one blade of grass in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're back to the, you know, back to the what free-range poultry is.
Yeah. Do you?
That's why many of us have shifted over to grass finished, because the grass finished does make that distinction that it's finished on grass, as opposed to that it ever ate a blade of grass. That's why grass finished has now kind of supplanted grass fed as the authentic end of this, you know, grass beef program.
Are there any regulations or rules or laws that keep an eye on that, on the labeling, or is it just something that we trust the source of grass finish?
Right now there's not much regulation on mm-hmm. it. It's a fairly open.
The Wild West.
You
got to know what you're doing. This is an email from Scott for Joe Salatin. Looking at purchasing around 15 acres here in the States or possibly down in Chile. Is it feasible on a much smaller scale in comparison to you and your farm to do the farming similar to what you have been going? So I guess they're asking if you have 15 acres, can they kind of do a Joe Salatin polyface model?
Right. Well, you certainly can, and the beauty of our systems with their, you know, portable infrastructure, and grass based, is that it is very scale independent. In other words, you don't have to. Your money is not tied up in infrastructure. Your equity is in management, and that's kind of neat because you don't have to borrow management from a bank.
Mm-hmm.
So, generally speaking, small acreage, small animals; big acreage, big animals. And so, yes, on a 15 acres, could you have two or three cows? Absolutely, you could. And but you know, poultry and even, you know, rabbits, guinea pigs, you know, small animals, is where you can really thrive on a smaller acreage. Your labor per acre is up, but your income per acre is way higher.
Mm-hmm. Julie wants to know, I heard you mention that you ship. Does that ship frozen, the meat?
Yes, everything is shipped frozen.
Does freezing meat affect it at all?
No, not if it's done well.
Mm-hmm.
Do
you cryopack it and squeeze all the air out?
It's cryovac, vacuum sealed,
mm-hmm.
It's frozen. It's flash frozen, so it's frozen fast. It's not frozen because it came up on a sell by date. It's frozen day of processing. So it's, you know, it didn't deteriorate at all.
Do you have to? I guess you do ship over 3-day FedEx, something like that, or how does that work?
Well, if it's over, we put some dry ice in the and there's some wonderful, you know, space age type insulation now.
Yeah.
It's all recyclable, and we take the boxes back. There's a technique that you can send them back real cheap. So we do that. If it's going to be longer than 48 hours, then we do airship it, and of course that gets more expensive.
Sure.
Which you know, we airship, you know, we ship to San Francisco, all over the place. Some people, they, you know, they're far more interested in having the quality product than, you know, paying extra for shipping, and that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's fine.
Here's an email from Jeff. Some people are suggesting that many of the meat packing plants are invested in the lab grown meat now. Where does Joe get his meat packaged? How do you do that? Do you do it on? Do you have places you go for that?
Yeah. So we have three possibilities. So here at the farm, we do most of our poultry here at the farm, the chickens and turkeys, and we do rabbit here at the farm.
Oh, you do?
Hmm. Uh-huh. And you know, ourselves. In fact, I was gutting chickens this morning before I came in.
Good for you.
And so then if we're going to ship, though, we need to be federal inspected. So we take the chickens down to a plant about 90 minutes away And they do the chickens that we ship across the state line to be legal. And the beef and the pork all goes to a small federal inspected abattoir about 30 miles north of us that we actually co-own. We own with a partner there. And so we have a little bit of clout. But it's a small 20 employee facility, and it's not one of these big places at all, and it services not just us but about 80 other small branded farmers in the area that direct market to their local client base. So we really do service the community and believe in servicing the community, and that's what we're in the business for.
There you go. Here's this from Kevin. I live east of your farm here in Richmond for about half a year now. I shop at the local natural food store that carries your eggs and ground beef. I was wondering, does your on-site store carry more cuts of beef, including organs? I don't mind driving to your farm to pick it up under certain items. Yeah. People are in organ meats these days, aren't they?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, our farm store has the full array of things, and so retail, we don't have by any means anywhere close to our full inventory variety in any retail outlet. They normally just want a couple of items and that's it.
Yeah.
So we don't have that variety there. Now I will tell him that we have two of these urban neighborhood drop points in Richmond. We service them once a month, and he can get on our website, Polyface Yum. The Polyface Farms is the website, but then look around there, you'll see Polyface Yum, and he could actually order and have it dropped, come to the rendezvous point there, and that also carries our full inventory.
As you know, pork is, and you're a Christian guy, fellow. So pork and the biblical thing and all that has had, they've kind of needed PR people over the years, right? Because the pigs get a bad rap, right?
Yeah.
But is there anything to it, to the pork than the cloved hoofs or whatever it is, that it's not good for you?
Well, I mean, that's an ongoing debate.
Yeah.
I mean, there are many people that do the blood tests and different things. And so, if you want to stick with the Bible, I tend to go with Peter's vision of the cloth being dropped down in Acts, and when he was told to go to the Gentiles and said, no, I can't go to the Gentiles. I'm a Jew. I can't go to the Gentiles and preach the gospel to them. And he had this vision of the cloth coming down and said, eat. And he, oh, no, I can't eat that. That's unclean stuff in there. And said, well, this is a new dispensation. We're under grace, not the law, and everything is okay. So we can look at that from a biblical perspective. But beyond that, I think that I wonder if some of these things were developed because at that time, there was a lot of filthiness in how they were handled.
I see.
And how they were raised.
Mm-hmm.
And so today, with electric fencing and good hygiene and controlled grazing and things, our pigs are not rooting through the village squat pots. And so there's a sanitary and an unsanitary way to raise them.
I have some pig's feet and ham hocks that I put on yesterday in honor of you coming on, with some garlic and onions and celery and carrots.
Mm-hmm.
And man, phew, that broth, I tell you what, there's something good going on with that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, a broth is an elixir. It really is an elixir.
And it does really help the gut, doesn't it, Joe? And they've used it for the autistic kids as well, the whole bone broth thing?
Oh, yes. And leaky gut syndrome. I mean, there's a lot of science now kind of linking up the whole, mental gut relationship, emotionally and mentally and all that. I mean, there's if you go down that path a little while, you'll really see some amazing relationships between gut health and mental health. And I mean, we have, I can't tell you how many customers we have who have children on the autistic spectrum. I mean, it's, you know, it's very common now. And they start down this path of better food and unprocessed food, a lot of broth, you know, whole foods. And, I mean, their kids just, if you didn't know it, you'd think they were completely normal. They become that functional over time. So it's a, you know, it's a wonderful thing.
We are now contacting a PhD type out of University of Pittsburgh that recently came out with a study, and they're kind of proving what we've known for a long time, that our angst and worry and fear, the big one, just messes up the gut. And they're proving it with the brain and the gut at these traditional, we're going to get this fellow on. So it's interesting to see that more and more information is coming out on this connection between what we think and what we believe and our spiritual perspective and the condition of our stomach.
Yes, that's correct. And boy, you know, if that isn't apropos for this whole, you know, coronavirus hysteria right now.
Right.
And, you know, again, it's too bad that we didn't have a control group that said, we're not going to shelter. We're going to go on about our lives. And instead of sheltering, we're actually going to make a point of hugging five people a day.
Yes.
We're all going to hug
for
a minute in length, 5 minutes a day, you know, the Dr. Zach Bush idea, and see if that actually created, you know, more health than quarantining.
Yes, sir. Final question, this one from Cynthia. Does your guest believe that the idea of vaccines, as Dr. Cowan on your show has said, messes with the innate immune system, work the same for animals?
Yes. In general, yes. And so we don't vaccinate anything. We don't vaccinate any animals, anything here. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a short-term, I want to say this very carefully, because I'm not a rabid anti-vaxxer. I think that there is, because I've seen that a couple of times. Two of the epizootics that I referenced back much earlier in the conversation, the one with the brambles, we were losing 2 600-pound calves a day, and that, you know, that's not like a chicken. That gets in your bank account pretty quick.
Yes, sir.
And so we did vaccinate that herd, and it stopped it quickly and immediately. But we never vaccinated another animal. But that was a crisis situation that we created. We got out of it with a vaccine, but we didn't continue to use vaccines after we rectified our mismanagement.
Okay. So how did you even figure out? Oh, go ahead. Excuse me for interrupting. Go ahead.
Well, same thing happened with a flock of chickens that we had a spring 1 year. We had a whole bunch of pullets, like, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 pullets, and the spring was cold and wet, and, you know, we were going to go out to the field with them at whatever, you know, at 5 weeks on, let's just say, April 15th. Well, I mean, it was frigid cold. We had days and days of cold rain. And long story short, we crowd them. They're continuing to grow. They don't look out and see that, oh, the weather's bad. We'll just not grow for a couple of weeks, you know, until it's nice to go out. They just kept growing. They got crowded. We had them in there in the brooder longer than they were supposed to be, and they came down with Merrick's disease, which is a thing you read about, you know, from back in 1900. And so it's actually a fairly weak thing, but it is devastating. I mean, flock mortality in chickens will usually be like 50%. I mean, it's just devastating. So we vaccinated, and we did that for 2 years, just to get us over the hump and get it through the system. We've never vaccinated again. Everything's fine. We've never had a problem again. And so I'm not ready to say, you know, no vaccines ever. No matter what, I think that there's a place for them at a certain time and place in a crisis situation. But if that's the basis of your health program, what you're doing is giving a crutch to your immune system overall, and you're moving in a weakened immunological direction over time.
Which is what the people who are concerned with vaccines, and because they haven't, like the Robert F. Kennedy and Dale Bigtree, because they've never proven them to be safe and or effective.
Correct.
Never.
That's correct.
Just have it.
Yeah.
And
frankly, perhaps we wouldn't even be having this vaccine debate if we had stuck with the three or four that they used to do in the 1950s
yes, sir.
Or 1960s. You know, I had whatever, four, between when I was one and six. Now the regimen is, 70 by the time you're 6 weeks old or something?
It's amazing.
It's just outrageous. And so, much of the anti-animal conversation, the vegan and conversation, has happened because of factory farming. Factory farming threw gasoline on that conversation. If we'd have never had factory farming, we would not have had perhaps PETA and militant veganism and that sort of thing like we have today, which I appreciate. The problem with the factory animal abuse in the factory farm, but the problem is not the animal. The problem is the management of the animal, and I think that vaccine in some ways is a similar situation.
And as you know, when you live out in the country like I do, and the other day I was walking this huge spider web, just beautiful, and this old ugly spider, and man, he was ugly. And he was just sitting there munching on a moth, and it just reminds you that everybody's eating somebody, right?
So, yeah.
Somewhere along the line, every living thing is eating something.
That's right. And if you don't believe it, go lie naked in your flower bed for 3 days and see what gets eaten.
Well, bacteria's eating somebody, and cows are eating somebody.
Sure.
Yeah. And plus, too, I know from a spiritual perspective, I believe that animals are souls, too. And if you treat them with respect, then we're just helping them also playing our part to allowing them to go and maybe reincarnate and come into a horse or something. I don't know. It's possible. That's the way I look at it. We're just helping you along, dude. Just have a good time. Well, Joe, you're fun to talk to. Thanks. So what are you going to do today as a lunatic farmer? What's on your schedule?
Well, so I dressed some chickens this morning.
Yeah.
They've got it all cleaned up out there, and I think they're waiting on me out in the field to come and run the baler. Everybody's gotten lunch, and so we've got a beautiful, beautiful afternoon, and I'm planning to be in the hay field and enjoy the intoxicating fresh smell of drying hay. It's one of the most it's one of the most special odors of my life. It's very, very enjoyable.
Well, if we ever get out that way and we'll bypass the swamp, we'll come and visit Polyface Farm and polyfacefarm.com, and you can look at the products that Joe sells around the country. You don't ship probably around the world, just in the U.S.?
No, just in the U.S., in the lower 48.
Lower 48,
states.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, for those of you in Portlandia, that does not include Alaska or Hawaii. We always, I can't believe I get I'm creating such Portland karma. I know I'm going to probably end up there someday. You know, I got to cut that out. Okay. All right, Joe, thanks a lot. And your latest book is called Beyond Labels, and that's available just everywhere, right?
Yes, it is available wherever books are sold.
Yeah, and we're going to get Sean on again because she was fun to talk to, too. All right, sir. Happy farming. Thanks a lot, Joe Salatin.
Thank you, Patrick. It's been a delight.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Salatin, Polyface Farms, the lunatic farmer. That's the real, man, I want to go visit there, don't you? Get some old moo cow juice and moo cow mojo and stuff like that. All right, kids, we're going to take the day off tomorrow. Good for us. We kind of take Thursdays off, and that's a day that we can hopefully get some done on our writing projects. But it's been so busy around here with so many people shopping online and such. But we do what we can, and we appreciate your ongoing support because that's what the way we make our living and make our house payments and stuff. So when you want to trade your Federal Reserve notes for some cool things, check it out, OneRadioNetwork.com. And remember, we have probably 3,500, go figure, 3,500 hours of free shows going back 12 years on OneRadioNetwork.com. 12 years of shows with Andrew Goss and The Real World of Money. That's now being picked up by Fred Jasiewski this morning. But shows that you'll find information about and find them through our search engine on the top right of our page. Put in just your favorite saying or a person that you want to hear from, and you'll find a lot of cool things on there. So please like us on Facebook. That just doesn't stroke our ego. That just helps, you know, share things and on YouTube and help share our shows to other people. We'll see you on Friday. We'll be on video, and we'll do Open Phone Friday. So I love you all very much, and let me know if I can help. Patrick Timpone, and may the blessings be.
Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.